there needs to be maximum pressure exerted to build on this. Because also, let's just think about the dynamics and the geography in play here. The Palestinian population has been displaced from the north of Gaza to the south. Israel now says that it intends to move from north to south. You have more people in a smaller area. Can anyone, in good conscience, make the claim that going forward, there will be a reduction in Palestinian civilian casualties, in dead children? So if the administration continues to refuse to call for a ceasefire, it is complicit. Now, those future agreements, which I think are still the off-ramp to getting a ceasefire, will involve further prisoner releases. And so the answer to your question, Amy, is that just as we have seen women and children being released now, in hopefully in the coming days, from being held in Israel and being released from Israeli prisons, in the future there will be further deals. And Hamas is not going to drive a soft bargain. Hamas has this leverage by holding these Israelis. It intends to use that leverage. When it comes to the soldiers it is holding, I imagine the release that they demand from Israeli prisons will be very significant indeed. And there's a proper debate inside Israel. And thankfully, you have courageous families who are getting up in the parliament, shouting at the right-wing ministers, standing outside the Ministry of Defense, standing outside the Prime Minister's office, meeting with the leaders, saying, save lives, don't end more lives. Prioritize, and this is going to be the debate, whether they prioritize the release of the Israelis, and therefore that means we're going to a ceasefire and we're going to see Palestinians released, or they prioritize prosecuting their war.
And Daniel, I wanted to ask you, in terms of the Netanyahu government and the public opinion polls are showing that Netanyahu's popularity is at an all-time low, even in the midst of this war. Far less, for instance, to the popularity of President Biden here in the United States. Is it your sense that regardless of what happens, that Netanyahu's with this war, that Netanyahu's political career is coming to an end?
From your lips, Juan. It's a risky thing to speculate on because he's such a political survivor. But I do think this time around, the path to staying on in power for Netanyahu is almost unimaginable. He is so unpopular. I think even some of the reservists who are fighting in Gaza are chomping at the bit to finish so that they can demonstrate outside his office to get him out. And here's the question that will follow in the coming days. Does even this pause begin to reignite politics inside Israel? Do we have to wait for the end of the war in order for Netanyahu to be replaced? There are open splits now, increasingly visible inside the government. One of the most hard right, openly racist and worse factions voted against the deal. Another intended to vote against the deal but pulled back at the last minute. We are likely to see some of the next 5 days, a lot of it will be filled with life-affirming images inside the Israeli media of Israelis coming home, but some of it will be now talk of what next. The opposition leader has called for Netanyahu to be replaced. So I think we're in a zone where that begins to come into view. But to be honest, the most important thing is to get the ceasefire, and the politics can come when it comes. If we need to get rid of Netanyahu to get the ceasefire, then of course that order switches.
Daniel Levy, we thank you for being with us, president of the U.S. Middle East Project, former Israeli peace negotiator with Prime Ministers Ehud Barak and Yitzhak Rabin. We'll link to your recent New York Times op-ed, The Road Back from Hell. Coming up, we speak with an Israeli history teacher who was jailed for 4 days and held in solitary confinement after criticizing the killing of innocent Palestinian civilians. Back in 20 seconds.
مخضب بدمه تبكي حروف اسمه من قال ما تبكي الروح البطن شاله والقلب يبكي طلوع الفجر يبكي وروب النوم يبكي لآخر يوم يبكي لآخر يوم يبكي ليل نهار يما عمود الدار عمر اللي قلبه مي زي اللي قلبه نار محروق فحم أسود من ريحته لو تسمع نبض القلب بركان وعيوني ما تفتح لم كلب شب أحزان وصدري لو تشهد طال سحب دخان.
Music by Hamada. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We turn now to look at how the Israeli government's cracking down on Israeli citizens who criticize their government's bombardment of Gaza. We're joined now by Meir Baruchin, a history and civics teacher from Jerusalem, who was recently jailed for 4 days in solitary confinement after he posted a message on Facebook about his opposition to the killing of innocent Palestinian civilians, especially women and children. On November 9th, Israeli police ransacked his house and arrested him. They also seized his phone and 2 laptops. Police interrogated him on suspicion of committing an act of treason and intending to disrupt public order. He was then jailed for 4 days and labeled a high-risk detainee. Baruchin has since been freed, but he's lost his job as a teacher and is still facing charges. Despite this, Meir Baruchin has refused to stay silent and is joining us now from Jerusalem. Meir, welcome to Democracy Now! It was hard for us to get in touch with you over the last few days because your electronic devices, like your phone, were taken. Can you talk about exactly what happened to you? What did you post? And then how did the Israeli police come to ransack your house?
First of all, thanks for having me. When I got to the first interrogation, the interrogators presented 14 posts, most of them before October 7th. There were posts from 4 years ago, from 2 years ago. Only one or two posts were after October 7th. What I'm trying to do in my Facebook posts is this. For most Israelis, Palestinians are really vague images. They have no names, no faces, no family, no hope, no plans. And I'm trying to give them names and faces, introduce them to Israelis, so more Israelis would be able to see Palestinians as human beings. So that's what I do in my Facebook. The police didn't like it, so they arrested me.
And when you were arrested, what was the substance of the interrogation against you during that time? And how were you treated?
On November 9th, I got a call from the police to come over for interrogation on sedition. I called my lawyer, and he said that in order to interrogate an Israeli citizen for sedition, they need an approval from the general attorney. The police did ask for approval, but was rejected. So they decided to interrogate me for intention to commit an act of treason and disrupt public order. The minute I walked into the police station, they shackled my hands and legs, and they showed me a warrant to search my house. 5 detectives took me to my house and ransacked the place. Then I was taken back to the police station for the first interrogation that lasted 4 hours. After that, I was taken to the jailhouse. I was, like you said, I was categorized high-risk detainee, separated from everyone. I wasn't allowed to bring anything with me, a book or something. I spent there 4 days in order not to go crazy. I exercise every hour and a half, 2 hours. On Sunday evening, November 12th, they took me for a second interrogation, and their technique was, it wasn't really asking questions, it was more of a rhetoric. When you install the answer inside the question, you don't really let the other person choose his own answer. For example, they said something like, as someone who justifies and legitimizes the rapes of Hamas people on October 7th, don't you think that, you know, that was their technique. Also, in my second interrogation, at a certain moment, they said that my Facebook posts are just like the protocols of the elders of Zion. Now, I'm history teacher, so I asked them, did you ever read the protocols of the elders of Zion? There was no comment. I was taken back to the jailhouse, and on November 13th, I was released by the judge, and still they kept me in the jailhouse for another 3.5 hours.
And what has been the response of fellow teachers in Israel and of the press to your arrest and detention?
Most of mainstream media embraced the statement of the police spokesman who accused me as justifying and legitimizing the rapes committed by Hamas people on October 7th. As for my colleague teachers, hundreds of them are telling me, Mayor, I'm fully behind you, but I have children to support. Mayor, I'm with you, but I'm paying a mortgage. Mayor, I'm with you, but my daughter is getting married. Mayor, I'm with you, but we just started to redecorate the house. They are afraid to speak up. They are afraid to lose their jobs. They see very clearly that these days, Israeli citizens who are showing the slightest sentiment towards the people of Gaza, opposing killing of innocent civilians, they are being politically persecuted. They go through public shaming. They lose their jobs. They are being put in jail. So they are afraid.
Last week, Haaretz, the Israeli newspaper, published an editorial headlined Arresting Arabs and Left-Wingers, How Israel Intends to Crack Down on Domestic Dissent Over Gaza War. In it, Haaretz wrote about your case, saying, quote, make no mistake, Bruchin was used as a political tool to send a political message. The motive for his arrest was deterrence, silence any criticism or any hint of protest against Israeli policy. Bruchin paid a personal price. So, Mayor, if you can talk about the fact that you were fired from your job, you have four children, right? And also, how unusual is your arrest and being put in solitary confinement, both for Israeli Jews and for Palestinians?
Well, first, I must admit that the fact that I'm Jewish played a key role in my arrest. Had I been Palestinian, it was completely different. There would have been much more violence from the police officers and also in the jailhouse by the wardens. I think it's a clear message for not only to the teachers, but to all Israeli citizens. One of the newspaper men from Yediot Achronot, Ben-Dor Yamini, he called me a soldier in the service of terrorist propaganda. In those specific words, other newspaper men, other journalists also embraced the police statement without getting my response or without even trying to challenge the police statement.
They took your phone and also your computer?
Yes.
Have you
they
gotten it back?
They took my phone. They took two laptops. No, not yet. My lawyer is working on it, but the case is still not closed. I'm still facing charges. Also, the Ministry of Education suspended my license, so I cannot go back and teach anywhere in the country.
And what do you tell your kids? We just have 30 seconds, Mayor.
My kids are proud of me, and that's the most important thing.
I want to thank you so much for being with us. Mayor Baruchin is an Israeli history and civics high school teacher who was jailed for 4 days, held in solitary confinement after criticizing the killing of innocent Palestinian civilians. His case is still open. He could still go to trial. He's speaking to us from Jerusalem. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show looking at how Israel's 47-day bombardment has left Gaza in ruins. Satellite images show the Israeli attacks have left about half of all buildings in northern Gaza damaged or destroyed since October 7th. Overall, researchers say at least 56,000 buildings in Gaza have been damaged. We're joined now by two researchers who lead the Decentralized Damage Mapping Group, a network of satellite image scientists using remote sensing to analyze and map the damage and destruction in the Gaza Strip. Corey Scher is a doctoral researcher at CUNY, the CUNY Graduate Center here in New York. And Jamin Vandenhoek is an associate professor of geography at Oregon State University, the lead of the conflict ecology group. Jamin, let's begin with you. Explain what you found in these charts, these images that you have of Gaza, where it stands today, where it stood a month ago.
Yeah, thank you, Amy, for the invitation to speak with you today. We've been charting damage using satellite radar technology since the start of the war across the entire Gaza Strip every 5 to 6 days. So we update our damage maps, we share them with journalists and humanitarian actors every 5 or 6 days, and we track what we identify as likely damage across the Gaza Strip. What we've seen is a really steady and fast expansion of damage across especially northern Gaza, as you mentioned, North Gaza Governorate and Gaza Governorate just last week, leading up to Saturday, were approaching 50% of buildings seeing likely damage. Now, there's still much less damage in southern Gaza. Rafah, for example, is maybe somewhere between 5 and 8%. But as your earlier guests were saying, we're expecting that to increase as the war continues.
And have you ever seen this scale of damage and destruction at such a rapid pace in any conflict in other parts of the world?
It's difficult to say. We haven't yet used the same approach to measure, say, the rate of damage in across Ukrainian cities or Syrian cities or Yemeni cities. But I think we've all been surprised at the speed of this. And part of that is just how compact Gaza is. If you look at the rate of progress of damage on our maps, it's just filling up the map of Gaza, especially in the north. And that's been consistently surprising to us.
I'd like to bring Corey Scher into the conversation. Corey, how does open access to these satellite images help understand and compare the impact of conflict?
Thanks, Juan, for the question. Open data helps us to maintain a consistent delivery of damage assessments, whereas it's been a big issue for journalists and humanitarian organizations acquiring very high-resolution satellite data from private companies. We don't face those issues because our work focuses on leveraging science and open data to make sure that we can provide a consistency and quality of this type of assessment across the duration of, for example, what's going on in Gaza. Open data is a cornerstone of the work that we do because it helps us bring transparency to this in a way that can't be interrupted.
I wanted to ask you about how rare your work is, which may surprise some people. Not reliant on commercial imagery, Semaphore recently reported earlier this month that key providers of satellite photographs to news organizations and other researchers have begun to restrict imagery of Gaza after a New York Times report on Israeli tank positions based on the images. Can you talk about this? In the early days of Russia's invasion of Ukraine, commercial satellite companies provided some of the most compelling images and insights into how the conflict was developing on the ground. And, of course, this has changed after Israel's attacks and invasion of Gaza. Corey.
Thanks, Amy. Well, I can't really comment on the politics or the policy of a specific company. All I can say is that leveraging open data that we use can guarantee that regardless of what's happening in the private sector, open Earth observation has the potential to at least give some type of insight into the impacts of conflict happening on the ground. So I think that's all we can really say to.
And could you talk a little bit more about what the difference is between commercial images and the ones that you use?
Yeah, thanks, Juan. So what we're doing is a scientific analysis of satellite radar data. So I want you to imagine a camera flash that you want to take a picture of something at nighttime. The camera flash leaves the camera, goes through space, bounces off the surfaces. Say you want to take a photo of me. So the camera flash goes off my face and then illuminates my face, goes back to the sensor. And then you have recorded an image. So now we're going 700 kilometers in altitude. There's satellite radar. Similar to a camera flash, a burst of microwaves, radar waves, go down to the Earth. They illuminate a region. And then the echoes of these waves scatter back to the sensor. And we can make an image. The sensors make an image regardless of day or night or cloud cover conditions. So this adds to the level of consistency where we can image a region. Every revisit of the satellite overpass, usually we have a good acquisition.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. Well, what we're doing is listening for very small changes in these echoes. So if you imagine walking into a room where there's no furniture, you listen to the sound of your voice echoing throughout the room, remember that echo, go back later after installing a carpet or a bookshelf, and you can hear a slight change. Scientifically, our algorithms are looking for very small variations in the radar echoes that bounce off the Earth's surface and go back to the satellite to map indicators of damage. So this is very much different than a picture, right? We're not looking at pictures. We're running satellite radar data through scientific algorithms we've spent years developing, ultimately to resolve these signals of damage.
Jamin Vandenhoek, if you can explain how open access to these satellite images helps you understand and compare conflicts, like what you see in Gaza, and how are your images different from commercial imagery and how you get it, and comparing Gaza, for example, to Mariupol in Ukraine?
Sure. As Corey was saying, we're sensitive to different kinds of things than one could see if you looked at basically a bird's eye view of Gaza. We are sensitive to lateral damage, so damage to the walls, the sides of buildings, structures that you can't see if you just look top down. That's a key difference just between optical overhead imagery and side-looking radar imagery. That's a bit technical, but that's an important difference when we have ground invasion. Not everything is air bombardment. Not everything has a roof being destroyed. The other aspect that Corey was touching on as well is, and you mentioned with the Semaphore article, are those restrictions where commercial providers, over many years of developing relationships with humanitarian actors, there's become a dependency on using commercial imagery in the humanitarian space, as well as in journalism, to monitor conflict effects on communities, landscapes, farms, forests. That's developed a kind of relationship with these commercial providers such that that's basically the literacy is using those kind of very high-resolution images, the kind you might see at, say, a Google-based map or an Apple base map in Apple Maps. Very clear, high detail. You can make out features. However, those images are usually very small scale. They're narrow strips of land. They're acquired in a sort of ad hoc and sometimes inconsistent manner. If there's cloud cover, you can't see through the clouds. Working over a country as large as Ukraine, for example, it's incredibly difficult to get wall-to-wall the entirety of Ukraine covered with commercial imagery in that way, not just because of the size of Ukraine, but because of all the atmospheric and weather effects that happen that obscure your view. Radar doesn't have those kind of limitations, and working with civilian spacecrafts, we're working with the European Space Agency Copernicus program Sentinel-1 satellite, which is an amazing satellite that's been in operations for about 8 years now. We don't have those restrictions, so we can, in a sense, just as easily detect conditions, damage, whether it's cloudy, whether it's day or night, it doesn't matter to us. We don't need visible light to do this. And we can also, because we have open access to it, and everyone does, you and Juan can go right now to Sentinel Hub and down your own satellite images and do this. Anyone has access to this. So there's a tremendous opportunity for democratization and transparency of the methods. We aren't hiding behind any sort of commercial barrier or some bespoke algorithm where the inner workings are unclear. We're trying to be incredibly transparent and be very direct with the limitations of what this approach offers, and sharing this with actors, journalists, humanitarian organizations who can do other things with it than we can. We can map likely damage. We can make estimates of damage structures. We cannot do all these other amazing things that so many people are working on the ground, as well as through sort of remote journalism practices. So it's become a very much a team effort where yes, we're doing this analysis in an open way, but then what we generate, we share, and then it's gone off and people have made amazing products that have really told a kind of a narrative that we've never been able to imagine, really.
Professor Van den Hook, have you been warned about what you're doing? Have you been warned? I don't hear you. Sorry.
Oh.
Go ahead.
There's nothing. No, we have not been warned. There's nothing illegal. There's about what we're doing. We're accessing open imagery. There's no. We have not been communicated with anybody about anything of this nature.
And Jamin, I'd like to ask you. You worked on a report with Amnesty International looking at the 2014 Israeli attacks on Gaza. And you also analyzed satellite imagery back then. How has the science evolved over the years?
It's like night and day. Back then, we were working with also open data, but a combination of commercial imagery. This system that we're working with now didn't exist at that time, this radar technology that we're using today. Working with Amnesty International, it was also led by forensic architecture. We were able to combine different kinds of satellite images to monitor very specific features. So we were able to see, say, individual trees destroyed by tanks or trucks in Rafah. But it was very localized, and it was also Protective Edge was such a short conflict, really, very, very brief. And so there we just looked at kind of before and after. That kind of before-after approach doesn't work with a conflict that's now a war that's now gone on 47 days. We're not interested in the after. We want to know the process. We want to know the pattern of change as it's manifest on the ground. Those concerns weren't really there for such a short conflict, but we also didn't really have the means to do it.
We just have 10 seconds.
Thank you. Every 5 days, we can update this, and we just have a much better sense of grasping the dynamics of this war than really any other conflict that we've looked at.
Jamin Van den Hook, we want to thank you so much for being with us, and Corey Scher, part of the Decentralized Damage Mapping Group, a network of satellite image scientists using remote sensing to analyze and map the damage and destruction in the Gaza Strip. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week, from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind.
The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse, independent, yours.